Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. In moments, we'll hear from the journalist Shane Bauer, who spent 2 years in an Iranian prison, a captivity that was probably lengthened by then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's hawkish talk. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the historian Jennifer Mittelstadt on the military welfare state. A few words about the presidential campaign. As you may know, I have a new book on a leading contender called My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency, from Orr Books. For more info, visit their website at orbooks, orbooks.com. When I first started researching Hillary in the summer of 2014 for a story in the November issue of Harper's Magazine, I thought that this was going to be the dullest campaign ever. As it's turned out, the Sanders challenge has interrupted Hillary's waltz for the nomination, and the initial Republican candidate, Jeb Bush, has fizzled profoundly. Since I now have a professional responsibility to keep up with the Hillary literature, I've been stunned by the weakness of the case for her. Over the last few weeks, we've seen a series of absolutely empty endorsements of her by writers for Salon, The Daily Beast, and The Nation. They make little or no political case for her beyond citing her alleged record fighting for the interests of girls and women, a record that consists mostly of speeches and photo ops. Joan Walsh had a piece the other day in The Nation announcing her passionate support for HRC that did not contain the words welfare, prison, poverty, inequality, or Iraq. In other words, not engaging with her endorsement of welfare reform, mass incarceration, her vote for the war in Iraq, or her intimacy with Wall Street and the CEO class. Amazingly weak stuff, but if you criticize her, you're dismissed as a misogynist. It's quite the con game. Okay, on to Shane Bauer. In July 2009, Bauer and two companions, his then-girlfriend and now-wife, Sarah Shurd, and a friend named Joshua Fatal, were arrested by Iranian border guards as they hiked near the Iran-Iraq border in Kurdistan. The Iranians accused them of spying, without any evidence, and threw them in jail. Their imprisonment was condemned by Amnesty International and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to little effect. Shurd was released after 14 months, most of it in solitary. Bauer and Fatal were released almost a year later. While imprisoned, they received no assistance from then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who missed few opportunities to breathe rhetorical fire at the Iranian government, a tough gesture that no doubt made her feel good, but only hardened the Iranians' resolve. It's one of the many paradoxes of Hillary's career that during her 4 years as the nation's top diplomat, she was consistently among the most bellicose members of Obama's cabinet. Another paradox, how she is touted as some sort of feminist icon, when opposition to war has always been a major theme of feminist thought. You never hear Hillary's liberal feminist supporters address this contradiction. With Hillary much in the news and Iran never far from a headline, I thought it would be worth getting Bauer's perspective on being at the receiving end of her strange form of diplomacy. Recall that she recently said that Iran is not the U.S.'s partner in the nuclear deal, but its subject. Bauer, now a senior reporter at Mother Jones, has done a lot of work in the U.S. prison system, particularly California, and especially the rampant use of solitary confinement, a horrible form of torture that has become completely routinized in U.S. penal practice. Shane Bauer. Shane, what were the conditions like under which you were imprisoned?
Well, I was held in Evin prison in Tehran, and I was in the unit that was kind of the run by the Ministry of Intelligence. It was the unit where political prisoners went. It was mostly Iranian political prisoners and a handful of foreigners like us. It was basically segregation. I was in solitary confinement for 4 months, and then I was put in a cell with Josh Fatal, who is one of the people that I was arrested with. And it would just be the two of us, you know, in our cell, and then we'd go kind of outside to an open-air cell for a short period. Generally, people were either in solitary confinement there or were in a cell with other people, but they wouldn't interact with people outside of their cell.
Did they say why they put you in solitary?
They said that it was because we were being interrogated. They didn't want us, you know, talking to each other. during that time. But I mean, we were kept in solitary for a couple months after our interrogation, and Sarah was kept in solitary for a full year. I mean, it seems like they basically wanted to keep us away from Iranian prisoners. Our guess is that they assumed that we would have somewhat of a platform when we were eventually released, and they probably didn't want us talking about other people's cases.
And what was it like, 4 months in solitary? What did it do to you?
It was terrifying initially, just being in a small cell and not having any escape, you know? I mean, I didn't have books at first. It was just sitting and staring at the light on the wall. And it's just hard to bear. I mean, it's hard to describe, but it's hard to kind of bear your own thoughts for that long and not have any interaction. And then over time, you know, I noticed that my thoughts would kind of slow down. I felt more kind of animal-like, you know, where I was having less of an internal life and I was just kind of like feeling and, you know, looking and looking forward to my food, and just not having actual dialogue really inhibits your ability to have any kind of internal monologue. My life was just focused on how to focus my mind. Sometimes I would just save my oranges for my meals so that I could practice juggling. Eventually I got, my first book was Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. So I just completely dove into that and would just like memorize poems, learned the Morse code at one point, you know, just anything that I had, I would use that to just kind of pass time.
And you've studied the California prison system.
Yeah.
How do they compare?
It's hard for me to speak about the Iranian prison system broadly, but the situation that I was in, you know, people would be in solitary confinement. I did hear people, not a lot, but there were several occasions that I heard what sounded like people being tortured, people screaming. You know, and these are political prisoners. This is a different situation than we have here. But here in the U.S., we have people who are in solitary confinement for decades. The last estimates by the Department of Justice say that at any given time, we have 80,000 people in solitary confinement. You know, what I ended up getting into after I got out of prison in my reporting was people who were in solitary for decades, mostly in California. That's what I was looking at. And a lot of them were in there because they had, you know, some literature, like Black Panther literature. The prison system was saying that was gang material. Could have been drawings. I mean, a lot of people were in there for nonviolent offenses and were basically named gang members for just kind of, you know, stuff they had in their cells, not for actually committing any violent crimes.
And parenthetically, the president ended juvenile solitary in federal prisons. There's apparently less here than meets the eye, right?
Yeah, I mean, I saw this yesterday and was like everybody who saw these headlines saying, you know, that the president ended juvenile solitary confinement was pretty excited about it. And then when I actually looked at the numbers, there's 26 juveniles in federal prison in total. So not really impacting that many people. I mean, at the same time, it does maybe set a precedent for the states to kind of follow. But the much bigger issue is, for federally at least, are the adults in solitary confinement. There's people in Florence, Colorado that have been in extreme isolation also for decades.
These are the people in the white rooms with no sensory stimulus at all, right?
Mm-hmm, right, yeah. I mean, juvenile solitary confinement is definitely a really serious issue and one that has been getting more and more attention, and there have been states taking action on it. I mean, when you're at a time in your life when your brain is still forming, obviously being put in solitary confinement is going to have a pretty significant impact.
Okay, now on to Hillary Clinton. During your time in prison, hers was not a voice you liked to hear, right?
Yeah. Initially, I was in solitary confinement, and then I was put in a cell with Josh. And I remember the first time that we heard Hillary Clinton's voice actually from a neighboring cell, and we kind of ran to the door, and she was basically, you know, demanding that Iran release us. And, you know, the feeling was kind of double-edged. It was like, okay, people are paying attention to our case. That feels good. But at the same time, it was really clear that demanding the U.S., anyone from the U.S., demanding publicly that Iran release us is not going to lead to our release. This became an ongoing issue where there were actually efforts, mostly on the part of Oman, to get us released. And they would be sort of interrupted. The Omani envoy would come to Tehran and he would get close. He told us on one occasion he got close to actually getting us out. And Hillary Clinton then came out and, you know, made this kind of, while he was there in these negotiations, made a demand that Iran, you know, immediately end its nuclear program and that kind of thing. And it's like, so it became this kind of ongoing frustration where these efforts would be getting foiled by public posturing.
I'm speaking with Shane Bauer, a senior reporter for Mother Jones, who spent a couple of years in an Iranian prison.
Do you know what was going on behind the scenes? Were they negotiating on your behalf, or are they just making public demands with contrary effects?
What we know is that, I mean, there were many countries that were actually involved in trying to get us out, but primarily it was Oman. And Oman kind of saw our situation as a step in a kind of larger game. What Omani officials have told me is that they basically wanted to get the U.S. and Iran talking about this nuclear issue. They saw it in their interest, partially for economic reasons and just national security reasons of, you know, they didn't want some kind of escalation with Iran, which is right next door. So they thought that if they could kind of start some kind of negotiation over us, that could open a pathway for bigger negotiations. There didn't end up being negotiations with Iran and the U.S. for us. It was mostly Oman kind of flying back and forth between this envoy flying back and forth between Tehran and D.C. and, you know, kind of giving proposals for both sides. But that pathway actually did end up, that was how nuclear negotiations did end up starting. That was where there were kind of the groundwork was laid for the more public negotiations after our release. But, you know, I've also done, you know, this isn't only coming from Oman. Our families, you know, we're always getting frustrated by the lack of effort on behalf of the State Department. I've been doing Freedom of Information Act work on this for a couple of years now, just trying to find out what happened. I've sued the State Department and the FBI to get records. And the records that I've seen so far, really, all they show is that the State Department was making public statements. Hillary Clinton was making public statements, and they were meeting with her families, and staffers were sending them news reports.
But apparently nothing going on behind the scenes, nothing in these released emails either about you guys.
No.
Do you think that they just didn't care about you, or is this part of a larger strategy that they had?
I mean, it's hard to say. I think on a personal level, I'm sure that they wanted to see us out, but there was just so much deadlock, gridlock with Iran. I mean, there was, on one occasion, after Sarah, who's now my wife, got out, she was kind of in this role for a while where, you know, Oman was sending messages from Tehran to her to bring to Washington. And she, in a meeting with Dennis Ross, who was then an advisor to Obama, passed on a message that was saying, you know, where Ahmadinejad was saying that if Obama would write just kind of a vague letter expressing hope for better relations in the future, then he would consider that enough to release us. And that was killed like immediately as soon as it was brought up. There was no way that was going to happen. There was just this idea that DC has been kind of gripped by, that any discussion with Iran was letting Iran win. That's changed, you know. I mean, that obviously there is some discussion now, but at the time that we were in prison, it was kind of just like no movement at all.
It looked like the transition from Hillary to John Kerry had something to do with that. Do you think that was part of the reason that things changed?
I mean, I think that had something to do with it. I mean, there's a larger dynamic going on that's hard to pin down. I mean, Hillary was like Kerry was, you know, doing the work of the White House also. I'm sure part of it has to do with what they're being told to do at the same time. But we don't see John Kerry negotiating and making these provocations at the same time with Iran. It's a really different approach.
And then the other day, after some prisoners are released, Hillary immediately, I think they were not even released yet, right? Hillary gets in front of a microphone and demands new sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, I mean, these guys got released. Four American prisoners got released, which was really surprising. And a major sign of the kind of larger negotiation and easing of tensions between the U.S., larger sign of progress on that front. After it was announced these guys were released, they were still in Iran. There was a lot of complications for hours on the ground in Iran. And while they were still there, Clinton called for new sanctions on Iran, which I thought was very irresponsible, was directly putting these people at risk. Iran has actually turned people back before. It's not hard to imagine that you know, if they felt slighted by the U.S., that they would call it off. And it just seemed like whatever the calculation was that made her decide to do in that moment, she felt that risk was worth it.
And Obama had already imposed fresh sanctions, minor compared to the previous ones, but
that actually happened later. So the sanctions that Hillary called for were then implemented the next day. They were implemented once these guys left Iran. And they were very minor compared to the sanctions that had been lifted previously. These new sanctions were about Iran's ballistic missiles program, and they targeted specific individuals and companies. You know, they're not going to have some big impact on the economy like the old ones did. But to me, following up lifting of sanctions and this prisoner release immediately with fresh sanctions is not really the message that we want to send if our goal is actually to have rapprochement with Iran.
You know, I suspect that's not what Hillary Clinton wants.
Yeah,
I think I saw a picture of you meeting with her, right, after you got released?
Yes.
What was that like? What was that meeting like?
Awkward, I guess. I mean, it was brief, and you know, we just basically sat in the office, and she, you know, asked if we had anything we wanted to say to her, and I don't remember exactly what I said, but I do remember saying that something along the lines of, you know, our approach with Iran is not making things, it's making, you know, it harder to get people like us out of prison. And there's this kind of a revolving door that Iran has, which, you know, ultimately is Iran's responsibility, that it's arresting, constantly having some Americans in prison, that it's trying to use as leverage. But it might help if we actually try to initiate some kind of relationship with this country.
That was Shane Bauer, who spent 2 years in Iranian prison and who is now a senior reporter at Mother Jones. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of In Prison, one of four sad songs by Bela Bartok, performed by the soprano Erika Sikle, accompanied by István Lantos. Apologies for my miserable Hungarian. This is one of many Hungarian folk songs that Bartok repurposed in high modernist style. Next, Jennifer Mittelstadt. Aside from being the world champion killing machine, the U.S. military is run as a comprehensive welfare state, a strange feature for the armed wing of a society that offers little in the way of social benefits to those not wearing a uniform. That welfare state was developed during the 1970s, when the Army in particular was making the transition from one staffed by conscripts to one staffed by volunteers. It was expanded during the Reagan years. But under Bill Clinton, the president who reinvented government and ended welfare as we knew it, the military welfare state was reinvented as well. Jennifer Mittelstadt, an associate professor of history at Rutgers, writes about this trajectory in The Rise of the Military Welfare State, which was published in October of last year by Harvard University Press. Jennifer Mittelstadt. Welcome. Let's start with the tale of the origins of the volunteer army. Coming out of the Vietnam War, people in the army were distressed at the state of the military, and you had people like Milton Friedman in the lead saying that the draft is akin to slavery, and let's turn the military into another profession. Let's treat it like all volunteer force and pay people accordingly. So give us the history of how we got from that draft army into a volunteer army. It was pretty bumpy way.
It was very bumpy, and especially from the perspective of the Army, which is the branch of the services I know most about. I mean, the Army relied on over half of its personnel as conscripts, and so the change, which came about really as a result of the unpopularity of the Vietnam War and the ensuing unpopularity of the draft for that war, it really posed this enormous threat for the Army. It was a surprise to me, actually, that Milton Friedman was at the lead for transforming the military into a volunteer force. But after reading through all the documents, I could see how it really made sense. The proposal was that, like many other parts of the government, this big institution should operate as a market institution. And it should draw on market principles in procuring the manpower. And that really held the day in the debate over what form the volunteer force would take. And so it became a recruited force, a force that would be lured by things like pay, and then more importantly, in the Army's terms, by things like benefits and social services, things that recruits probably couldn't find in as generous a form, especially from the class backgrounds they came from in the civilian world.
At first, the pay was really nothing to write home about, was it?
No. In fact, in order to convert to a volunteer force, they had to raise pay substantially, and that was really the first order of business. That was a model, actually, a pure pay model was the model that Milton Friedman and the free market economists who drafted the plan wanted. Actually, what they wanted to do was get rid of all the traditional military benefits and services to personnel because they thought of those in the same way that they might think about other government programs, really as sort of wasteful socialistic spending. In the event they didn't get their way, the Army and other branches fought back hard, but pay was what they advocated, and so they raised pay substantially in order to convert over to the volunteer system. Pay, though, still in the military only comprises anywhere between 60 and 70% of the total what we would think of as compensation package. So if you just look at base pay for any rank, really, it's going to look, I don't know, perhaps in comparison to some things in the civilian world, like it might be on par or a little bit lower. But when you consider the total compensation package, the allowances, the benefits, the social services, that's really where the compensation package gets larger.
We're talking about the early 70s when this transition happened?
Yes. It was. It was the early 1970s. So 1973 was the official start of the volunteer force.
And there were concerns among others at the time that this was leading to a decline in the quality of the military, that it was bringing in the dregs of society, right?
Yes. This was a concern. And actually, it's really interesting because it comes out of an era that was probably equally concerned with what was happening to the Army, which was the Vietnam era. So the end of the Vietnam War featured this really dramatic breakdown in morale and in discipline, and there were many who sort of forecast the end of the institution. So the switch to the volunteer force was in some ways a proposition for changing that, right, to bring in people who wanted to be there. But the funny thing was observers weren't happy with the new recruits who were coming in either. They were worried. They were worried that these new recruits looked like a different demographic. They drew far more from the lower income quintiles in the United States, so working class or below, not the very poorest, but those just above. The demographic switch in race was remarkable and swift, so that African Americans, really by 1980, represented about 30% of the Army, and in some units, in infantry units, that would be up around 50%. The number of African American officers grew by 500% in the 1970s. And there was a lower level of educational attainment, so that whereas during the draft, even during the Vietnam War, when so many middle-class white men avoided service, after 1969 in the lottery, you really couldn't. And so the draft had about 28% of the enlisted personnel had some college experience. But once we switched over to the volunteer force, that dropped down right away to about 5%. And so you were really looking at a much less educated force. And this created a kind of crisis. And the crisis was not actually unconnected to what Americans thought about a kind of crisis of poverty and welfare in the nation as a whole. People started to talk about soldiers and recruits as if they were akin to welfare clients, sort of people who couldn't make it on in the real world, people who needed to lean on a big public institution, people for whom new services like remedial reading programs would have to be created in the military. So the switch to the volunteer force, you know, had its own crisis, a different crisis than the Vietnam era, but it had its own crisis nonetheless.
You write some, although certainly not your major topic, but you have a bit about the general social prestige of the soldier over time. And you know, now we revere the soldier, the warrior, but there was always an aspect of the lowlife about the soldier, wasn't there?
There really was, and this is, I think, one of these aspects of our present day that sort of lures us to misunderstand the past. For most of human history, people who fought in wars have not come from the top levels of society, and mostly not from the middle levels of society. For understandable reasons, people who could buy their way out or work their way out from status chose not to do the dirty and dangerous work of fighting wars. And this was true in the United States. It was true during the Civil War, and you can look at the draft riots in New York City as some evidence of that. In the 20th century, with the large-scale mobilizations of World War I and World War II, and then the maintenance of a large peacetime army, you did get a bigger cross-section in terms of class, more middle-class people serving than you would have seen at other times. But I think still, you know, the image of the soldier has always been one that's not exactly easy to legitimize. Effort has had to go into making them legitimate figures. And this effort really was poured into the volunteer force in a way, I don't know, perhaps unparalleled in U.S. history. I think people like Ronald Reagan were key to doing this, with identifying the soldier with the nation, right? The military with the nation, the soldier with the best of American citizenship, sort of lending a symbolic legitimacy, almost a super legitimacy, really, over time to service personnel. But actually, there's still an undercurrent of illegitimacy and disdain, I think, that still runs below the surface. And I think we see it in the way that the genuflection to military personnel seems actually, honestly, largely symbolic in many ways. I think there are a lot of people who feel very disconnected from them and don't think that much about their fate or what's happening to them and think they chose it and do think that they came from working class backgrounds and it's a good opportunity for them, so it's not really a big deal. So, you know, the soldier is sort of revered, or now they call them warriors, for heaven's sake, but they're revered in our political culture, but I think it's still an ambiguous position.
Well, anybody with a Freudian background would be suspicious of that kind of heavily advertised reverence as being a defensive overreaction to something or other.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, yeah, you mentioned the Reagan years. That was a period when money was showered upon the military, but starting in the early 1980s. So what happened to the military welfare state during the 80s?
Well, the military welfare state, it began then in the 1970s with this switch as the military, especially the Army, basically said to Congress, we can't go this volunteer route unless we have things to lure people in. And since we're not going to raise pay that high and we don't like the model that Milton Friedman set up. And this is an important point. The military resisted this free market model and insisted on maintaining its own in-house forms of social welfare in order to create loyalty between military personnel and the military. So they had sort of made this case, and the programs had been growing despite the recession in the 1970s, actually. And the military expanded programs that had once been very special and reserved for career personnel or officers to every enlisted man or woman and his or her family. So they had started to grow in the 1970s, but it really isn't until we have the largesse of the Reagan administration and this huge defense budget that the programs grow enormously. And the real marker there in the Reagan years is the creation of an elaborate set of family service programs. So these range from everything like daycare to family counseling, after-school programs, child and youth programs, a lot of sort of soft social service counseling and things like that. And then there was a renewed effort to build new housing, expand military family housing, and sort of all of it received more funding than it had before. So it was a remarkable period of growth, really the apogee of the benefits and social services of the military.
It sounds almost like Bernie Sanders' Denmark.
Right. Well, you know, this is the joke, of course, within the military. I'm hardly the first person to have noticed that the military has this welfare function and has a robust welfare state. Nobody knows better than people who are in the services. And there was a joke that circulated during the Cold War that the U.S. fought communism with the most socialistic organization it had, which was the U.S. military. So, yeah, it did have that component. And in important ways, it's an incredibly well-functioning social welfare state, probably better functioning than anything that's in the civilian world. It's comprehensive. That is, it covers everything, you know, from health care to education to housing. It covers you without respect to need. It covers all members of the family. If you have five children or if you have one children, you're compensated according to what you need, not according to sort of one disbursement that's equal for everyone. So it really is like a socialist state within the military.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Mittelstadt, who's an associate professor of history at Rutgers and author of The Rise of the Military Welfare State, just out from Harvard University Press. Now, this program fit Reagan's political needs in that he wanted to delegitimize civilian social spending. And so the Army, the warrior, as we're calling him now, was perceived as a legitimate recipient of these kinds of benefits. And civilians were just a bunch of moochers, right?
Yeah, and this was something that I didn't expect to see. So before I came to study the military, I had been studying civilian social welfare programs. And from that perspective, of course, the Reagan administration had a powerful and pretty negative impact on social welfare in the United States. What I didn't understand was just how the military fit into that. And what I discovered in looking through the Reagan years, I guess, was two things. I mean, one was, in many cases, there was not a kind of guns for butter trade-off. So I couldn't trace explicitly across a wide range of programs Reagan saying, you know, yay, now I get to cut all of these civilian programs and I'm going to give all that money in turn to the military. But he did in some cases. And the case in which he did that was the revival of the GI Bill. The GI Bill had been suspended, of course, after the end of the Vietnam War. The idea was we weren't at war. We didn't have to compensate veterans. And anyway, we'd be under a new rubric of recruitment and retention with a volunteer force, so we could drop it. Well, the Army was really disappointed with letting it go because it started to realize that the GI Bill could actually work not so much as a reward on the other end of service for conscript, but rather as a lure to get somebody to come in the first place. So they lobbied quite hard to have it brought back. And Reagan got on board, actually. And what Reagan saw and what the people in his administration saw was that they could valorize soldiers by providing them with a new GI Bill while at the same time cutting aid to higher education for civilians. And the student loans and grants program was a program that they had sort of long disliked. And what was really interesting was in this particular case, it sort of was a guns for butter trade-off. So they were very explicit in their memos in discussing the matter, that what they wanted to do was take the money away from civilian programs and put it into a military GI Bill. And then they also sort of did that rhetorically in politics. They began to talk about the, I guess it's really the illegitimacy of civilian claims on loans for higher education when those people sacrifice nothing, whereas military personnel, in their view, sacrifice something, and so we're the only people who are deserving of government support for higher education. And this, I kind of think about, when I thought about that and when I started reading more about the way, when and where Reagan talked about the military, he often talked about it in the same discussion as his attack on the civilian welfare state. So the two were, it was in close conversation for him. And I think in the way I think about it is that the rise of the military welfare state, a kind of militarized notion of citizenship and entitlement, it's one side of the same coin where civilian entitlement is attacked.
You have to earn your entitlements in America, right?
You have to earn your entitlements, absolutely.
The Army was...
In a militarized way, I'm sorry. You have to earn your entitlements, and you have to earn your entitlement in a militarized way. That was one of the legitimate ways that you would earn it.
The military at this point was constructing itself as a family, and it was taking care of its family members. And in stepped some folks in the Christian right, like James Dobson, to Christianize that family, right?
Yes, and this to me was a surprise in terms of the directness of the connections between the military and the conservative Christian right. So the military, the Army, and I'll talk about the Army because that's what my research is about. The Army conceived of itself as a family, as an Army family, really started using that language in the 1970s. And what they meant there was a sort of paternalistic relationship in which they would take care of soldiers, the Army would take care of soldiers, and soldiers would in turn be loyal to the Army. And in the 1980s, it sort of takes on a different cast because the Army's discussion of the importance of family actually becomes a discussion about the importance of individual, moral, and Christian families within the Army, and a discussion about the lack of moral and Christian families outside the Army. So the Army leadership, people like General John Wickham, who was chief of staff of the Army in the 1980s, were themselves actually converts to born-again Christianity sometimes in the late 60s or in the 1970s, and they began to forge relationships with leading evangelical Christian leaders in the civilian world. And these really became tight in the 1980s. And so James Dobson actually was invited by the Army to serve on its Family Advisory Committee, which would craft these new policies that were growing during the Reagan administration. So they played an important role in shaping the tone behind the Army's depiction and construction of the family programs.
Now, this rhetoric around the family, doesn't that threatened to undermine the tough masculine nature of a military with rather soft and almost feminine values?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think that's been one of the ambiguities and difficulties of incorporating families in a welfare state into an institution that is essentially a highly martial, masculinized institution. What I found in observing the history of this military welfare state from its inception in the late 60s all the way through 2000 was that there's ambivalence, like real ambivalence that you can find. So there's times when the military is quite proud of its welfare state and of the families that are in its midst. The more they're kind of coded as Christian patriarchal families, I think the better in that regard. But then there's times when they're quite leery of all the families in their midst, particularly the women who are in those families, whether they're female personnel or more likely, more numerous, they're the wives of personnel. They're leery about what it means to have so many women and so many programs that, like childcare, for example, that are now these huge features of the military and are expensive.
So that sounds like it's French almost. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly, which is not popular with the military. You know, there were outspoken people who, often they were recent retirees, they had sort of recently left the Army, and they worried about the feminization of the Army as a result of both the changing demographics in the Army, that is, more women, more families, and the advent of this elaborate system of social welfare. I mean, I think it's telling that in 1996, the commandant of the Marine Corps suddenly, on his own, just announced that they wouldn't be recruiting any more married Marines. And that, I think, was a signal of the kind of discomfort that many had within the military about this shift to a military welfare state and the demographics that came along with it. You know, in the event, Les Aspin, who was Secretary of Defense at that time, you know, quickly rebuked him, and that was that. the Marines continued to recruit married Marines. But there's this sort of budding discomfort and dissatisfaction with it that I think has very much to do with feminization versus a masculine military.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Mittelstadt, who's an associate professor of history at Rutgers and author of The Rise of the Military Welfare State, just out from Harvard University Press. And now, moving rapidly along, over the last couple of decades, there's been a shift both in the rhetoric away from this we'll take care of you as a family line towards more self-reliance, and there's also been a move towards contracting out. So, you know, give us that history. But how have things been changing over the last couple of decades?
Well, this, I have to say, was astonishing to me. When I started researching this project, I was researching it in chronological order. So here I was watching these programs build up, and then I watched them sort of lauded in the Reagan era. And then as I got into all the sources in the 1990s, I was shocked to find these two fundamental changes that were really not dissimilar at all from what was going on in the civilian world and civilian social welfare. And that was, number one, an emphasis on fighting dependency. So defining people who used social welfare programs as somehow dependent, inadequate people, and trying to produce in them self-reliance or independence. And then also an effort to privatize programs that were essentially government programs, if those programs were around social welfare.
Now, was this during the Clinton years? Because, you know, you're reinventing government and ending welfare. This seems sort of Clintonian.
They're totally Clintonian. Clinton is at the heart of all of this. I would say if we're looking at the ending welfare as we know it, which is what the military sort of started to talk that talk. Actually, the Army changed its motto in 1995 from the Army takes care of its own to the Army takes care of its own so they can learn to take care of themselves, which is a rather awkward phrase, but really indicated the shifting mindset of leaders within the Army who are very unsettled by the number of families and soldiers who seem to be relying upon it for their social and economic welfare. And at the same time, Clinton establishes the National Performance Review with Al Gore, where they're going to reinvent government. And I had no idea when I started this project how vital this was to privatizing the military. The reinventing government basically pressed many aspects of the federal government to outsource as many of its functions as it could in an effort to save money. That was the goal, that they were going to save money. And there was this belief that people in the private sector could do the work of government more efficiently or effectively than people could in the public sector. In the Department of Defense, this meant that there was a new Office of the Undersecretary for Economic Security, and this man, Joshua Gottbaum, who came from Lazare Frères, he's actually the son of Victor Gottbaum, who is a famous New York labor leader.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, because during the fiscal crisis, Victor Gottbaum became good friends with Felix Roth and of Lazard, so evidently his son went to work for Lazard and became an investment banker.
He did. And when he came to work for Clinton in the Department of Defense, his mandate was to outsource as much as he could. He had been an expert in mergers and acquisitions in the corporate world and was well aware of what the defense contracting looked like at that time, was also well aware that defense contractors with the end of the Cold War were looking for new markets. And if they couldn't get the same amount of money in weapons and materiel, they could get it in military services. And so military services were really the hot new market for existing military contractors who then had to turn themselves, they had to basically buy non-weapons companies. You know, companies that would build housing, companies that would provide health care, companies that did accounting. They bought all these companies and then secured that portion of the military market through outsourcing. So the 1990s were this period of enormous transition. So if there's a rise of the military welfare state in the 70s and 80s, I don't know if it's a fall in the 1990s, but it's a profound transition that really puts the military welfare state and military personnel and their families in a much more precarious position than by the turn of the 21st century.
Getting to the 21st century, we've got two long and bloody wars. How did the military welfare state deal with that?
My archival research sort of stopped at the year 2000, but my secondary source research, so sort of reading journalistic reports and other works on the military, went all the way up through the present day. And I guess one of the things that I realized in looking at the experiences of soldiers and looking at what happened with programs to support soldiers and families was that when Don Rumsfeld said you go to war with the army you have, not the one you wish to have, well, the military went to war with the military welfare state it had. And the one that it had already done important things that had made life a little more precarious and a little more difficult for soldiers and families. So it had already taken on this motto of you have to take care of yourselves. You have to be more independent. You can't rely on us that more. And then they took that whole system that they had transformed in the 1990s into war when the stresses on soldiers and families would be enormous. They also took into war this privatized system. So they took into war a highly privatized healthcare system that was becoming more privatized by the minute. And that proved difficult. So one of the difficulties that came out of the crisis in Walter Reed, for example, had to do with the ineptness and, I guess, really the internal conflict over privatizing at Walter Reed that made the contractors there do really poor work with the personnel who were there. So I think that soldiers and families didn't fare very well with the military welfare state in the early aughts, and I don't think the military welfare state itself fared that well. And the military, for its part, I think scrambled to play catch-up. And so it's had problems with physical health, with mental health of service personnel and their families, and have really had to try to figure out how they're going to retool after they'd sort of toned down their rhetoric of taking care of people, after they'd gotten rid of some programs, after they'd put in programs that were aimed at independence and stuff like that. The truth was they had people with serious difficulties who needed a lot of support, and they had to figure out how to try to remedy that problem.
Well, it seems like as a society, we just sort of cast them aside because we have a lot of very damaged people who came back from Iraq and Afghanistan who are just not getting very good care.
It's true. And, you know, one of the complicated parts of this is that there are two systems involved. Those who remain on active duty are the ones I know most about because that's part of the active duty military social welfare system. Those who actually transition out of the military after a short period of adjustment are part of the VA system, which is actually quite a different system of medical care. In both cases, yeah, there have been enormous difficulties. For all the attention that the VA has gotten lately, I'm inclined to think that the evidence points more toward the difficulties actually within the services, that it's those people who are being treated after one tour, two tours, three tours, it's them and their families who are actually having the most difficulty in accessing ongoing mental and physical support. That is really where I think there continues to be a crisis.
That was Jennifer Mittelstadt, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers and author of The Rise of the Military Welfare State, which came out a few months ago from Harvard University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of I Love a Man in Uniform by the Gang of Four. I don't really, but it's a great song. Till next week, bye.